Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back. We're back. It's the Deadcast. This is Tim Marchman. I'm joined by...
It's me, David Roth.
Hey, Lauren Tyson.
All right, good. Yeah, that's what you wanted us to do. Good.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I was gesturing with my hands. Right. You people who are listening can't see this, but I wanted
to... I'm used
to
waiting
to
like 5
themselves.
Minutes until I'm allowed to talk, so...
Relax.
This feels good.
Relax, please.
Folks, we've got to cut to the chase here. This is a special emergency Deadcast. We have lots of sports to get into, but I think the sports topic of the day, the week, the month, the year, the decade, maybe the incident. Donald Trump invited the Clemson football team to celebrate their national championship, and it was beyond anything we could have hoped. We know you, the listener, know what we're talking about, but we have a lot we need to unburden ourselves of. Many, many questions.
First of all, I'm so happy that we're recording this a day earlier than this is usually recorded, because like we would have had to all rush in here anyway if this wasn't already the plan.
Like, I got here by hopping into a fireman's pole in my bedroom, just shooting down and landing in the studio, at which point someone just started yelling hamburgers at me. But this is good.
1,000 hamburgers.
Yeah, I heard it's 1,200 now. You hear so many more. All right, so obviously this is fresh in our minds because the trauma is new. It's still, I think honestly, we're still
unyielding.
We're still trying to figure out just how many hamburgers President Trump bought for the Clemson football team. But either way, as the number is more than any of us will be able to bear.
Lauren, when you think about Donald Trump doing jazz hands in front of in front of hundreds of soggy, damp, wet,
71 degree burgers,
congealing, coagulated meat wads.
Oh my God. What
stands out to you? Like a big thing, a little thing, a detail others may have overlooked.
This is literally my favorite story of the Trump presidency. I'll say that much. Like, this is like, you know how on Saturday Night Live, like, they'll portray him as this sort of like arrogant buffoon or whatever, and that's not really who he is? Well, this is that. This is like the hilarious character that centrists sort of think he is. And it's perfect because I'm not in like immediate fear of my life because of McDonald's or Burger King's or whatever else he got. I'm just like... so happy about this. This was a child's birthday party at the White House.
For the football boys. His friends, the football boys.
It was so great. The thing I didn't actually see, I saw they had pizza. I didn't see what the pizza was, but in my head, I'm imagining it as, no, Domino's specifically, but also, have you seen the tweet where it's like somebody ordered the pizza, the nun pizza with left beef?
Yeah.
That is exactly what I'm picturing that they had. Like, I don't know what the toppings were at the White House, but I think it was nun pizza with left beef.
That's how Trump would order it. Like, he'd be like, I don't care for the cheese. Sauce seems a little effeminate, like mostly like what he wants.
It's like a plain hamburger, basically.
Yes, that's what he wants. He wants a hamburger bread and that's round. For me, we mentioned it earlier. It's the stacks. It's the stacks on stacks of condiments arrayed in like fine china and on like weird plinths with just pile like a ziggurat of fucking filet of fish on top of it. It's all been leading up to this. Now, I think I agree with Lauren.
Charles de Gaulle gave this to Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes, that's what's incredible about it.
It's got tartar sauce packets.
Every one of those tables is like 250 years old. Like something important happened to that table. Like Harry Truman was like praying at that table. And now Trump is like, oops, I accidentally dropped some mayo on it. Somebody should get that. Not me. I don't do that. Incredible shit. So I agree with Lauren that this is the finest moment of the presidency. The only one that I would put up in the same even universe is one that had a similar vibe. And I don't know if this makes me a Trump hipster for remembering this because I don't know if it's as memorable. The first Halloween party that they had at the White House.
When
he walked out to Ghostbusters and specifically walked out at the moment they flung the doors open when Ray Parker Jr. said, "Bustin' makes me feel good." And that was his cue to walk out. So to me, that is the like the purest distillation of like the happier version of Trump. Like that's the version of him. Because like the rest of him is him just like sitting there like yelling curse words at his TV and like trying to like thinking he's having a conversation with Lou Dobbs for like 90 seconds before he realizes that Lou Dobbs is on his TV and can't hear him. Like, that's bad, obviously. And then, of course, the, you know, the child internment camps, not great. But him, like, giving specific instructions to the Marine band on how they're supposed to play the Ghostbusters theme so that it most honors, like, our troops and first responders. Like, that's my fucking guy right there. That's our boy.
I have so many details stood out to me. The fact that he was wearing an overcoat for no reason, yep, without a suit jacket
indoors,
apparently.
It just looked like a long coat. Like, it looked like he was wearing like the
it's like a Chesterfield.
Yeah, like he was dressed like Steve Harvey, the original Kings of Comedy. Like, it's just a
there's that there's Abraham Lincoln looking extremely pensive and judgmental in the photo, yeah, right behind him, and really the lack of any sort of chafing dishes. Like, I would have thought that even with the shutdown, they could have had like Secret Service guys go into the pantry and, yeah, get some sterno, put
hard
the burgers in like you know, like foil dishes or whatever. But there was nothing. There was no evidence of anything that could have retained heat.
Yeah.
Wait. Okay. So you would have preferred that the burgers be taken out of the cardboard and just sort of all dropped together. In a,
yeah,
pot
or heat lamps.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's how he does it.
I don't know if they have heat lamps at the White House.
They have to. I mean, you can't take that away in the shutdown. Like, all this stuff, because that's, he doesn't like eating food that's just been cooked. Like, he likes eating food that's had like a couple of hours to improve under some sort of tempering, you know, like either a sterno thing from below or a sad orange heat lamp from above. And then he likes to go up there and have somebody carve a rump roast onto a paper plate for him.
Do we know where the salads came from?
Probably Wendy's, right?
I wouldn't know specifically now.
Yeah, I have questions. So there was Wendy's, Burger King's, McDonald's.
Which has officially been forced by a presidential mandate to pluralize its name now.
Mm-hmm. Pizzas and salads of mysterious provenance.
Yeah.
I gotta say, the inner 6-year-old me actually really was excited for the crossover potential that was presented to the Clemson team and you know, their associates, because if you're a kid, think about what's cooler than being able to like dunk Burger King fries,
yeah,
in a Frosty, or like put you know, put special sauce on a Wendy's double.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like when you first see like a combination like Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, and you're like, whoa,
my God,
those things, yeah, can too. Now those two things can fit together.
Now there's like 9 ingredients behind that counter.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, the All-Star game, pre-interleague player, like a DC versus Marvel crossover.
Yeah, that's how, and I think for Trump, like if he obviously is not familiar with the phrase absolute power corrupts absolutely, because the only phrases he knows are like, you know, whatever, like hasta la vista, baby. Like, it all stopped in like 1986. But I think that for him, absolute power means being able to have like filet of fish on one like brass standee, and then on the next brass standee, like, you just have Burger King.
It's like how, if you ever listen to like country songs on the radio, they sing about how they want to be rich, but they just want to buy more of what they already,
yeah,
have,
the same
basically
thing.
Like, they'll just
the same
like a guy will just sing about wanting to get like a bigger RV,
yeah,
and that's basically what we're doing here, just 1,000 hamburgers from, yeah, McDonald's instead of like one,
which is great. I mean, this is because he's gonna do the same, like, his food stuff, like, we talk about this a lot, although I think also probably not enough. His tastes are incredible little child's tastes that, like...
Well, there was that story in The New Yorker about Mark Burnett, the producer of Survivor, mm-hmm, who almost assuredly has, like, hundreds of hours of Trump shouting racial invective,
yep,
that he mysteriously refuses to release. But there was an anecdote about Burnett is summoned to, you know, the Trump penthouse in Trump Tower for dinner, and he thinks there's going to be, you know, steaks and potatoes,
yeah,
and asparagus and shit
rich
like that.
Rich guy food.
And Trump actually just pulls out like a sack of burgers,
yeah,
from McDonald's.
Just hands him like something wrapped in paper. Here you go, asshole.
So what are you guys taking then if you're at the White House at that dinner?
Oh,
what do you,
boy,
grab?
I mean, because as Tim mentioned, everything is old. Like, it's been through, like, multiple, like, just, like, those, like, giant, like, tubes of, like, people are checking to see if there's somehow, like, if there's razor blades, is there plastic explosive in the filet of fish, whatever. So once they've satisfied that everything is safe, probably 2 hours after it was brought to the White House, which is an hour after it was prepared, you're thinking mostly, like Trump at that point, what is safe? And for me, because if I'm in that situation, I'm at the White House, I'm eating fast food with a guy whose brain is just like just a wad of ham, just a wad of old ham that's been mushed up in somebody's fist. At that point, I want the worst experience that I can, which is also the most representative. So I'm eating a fillet of fish that was cooked hours earlier. I'm eating like two of them, and then I just want to find a room to lie down in.
Mm. What are you having, Lauren?
I think I worry the most about the burgers. I think like room temperature pizza is at least okay.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Yeah.
Anybody who works in an office knows.
I think I take the pizza and cross it over with the french fries. I think like lukewarm McDonald's french fries are still okay. Yeah. But I definitely avoid all of the hamburgers. I'm not going to eat a cold hamburger.
My wife at her birthday party when she was like five had a french fry and pizza experience. Mm. And that was like the ultimate for her. But then she got orange juice with it and barfed.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's bad. She didn't know. She was five.
Oh, she flew too close to the sun.
She did. She did. She gleamed the cube. So Tim, what's your order at the White House?
I really don't know. I think it depends if there are drinks offered, because I'd get completely inappropriately shit-faced if I had to accompany the Clemson football team to hang out with Donald Trump eating six-hour-old Wendy's.
Yes.
So if there were drinks, I think
8-year-old scotch and then like a day-old burger. That's what it's about.
I think I would like double fist a quarter pounder and like a Whopper and just get it over with. If there were drinks, if there weren't, I would pick at the salad, but I wouldn't put dressing in it because that would seem like a vector for disease to me.
I just want to do one last bit on this. Obviously, we can't do an entire podcast about this, or can we? But I think I want the tweet that Trump made this morning, which he's since deleted because it had a typo in it. There's one last little bit from it that I think is germane to this conversation, and I'm quoting now. Great being with the national champion Clemson Tigers last night at the White House. Because of the shutdown, I served them massive amounts of fast food, parentheses, I paid, close parentheses, over 1,000 hamburgers, etc. Within 1 hour, it was all gone. Great guys and big eaters.
Now, literally,
go ahead.
Just picture 1,000 hamburgers. Like, try to comprehend what that would actually look like.
You have to
compared to the spread that was
your
there.
Mind needs to be so luxurious to comprehend 1,000 hamburgers. So obviously, the typo is bad. The fact that fast food is capitalized, like initial caps, also extremely Trump. But whatever, this is all new. Like, again, his mind's just porridge. To me, him focusing on the fact that everybody ate a lot is a very Trump thing that he would love to, because like these aren't real people to him. They're just like football guys that you can like mash together on like a magnetized football game setting. But he'd be really impressed and will continue to exaggerate over and over again over the next couple of years. Like this will be a campaign trail thing where he'll be like, Dabo Swinney, a great friend, close friend of mine, he was there at the White House with the Grimace. They each ate 200 hamburgers. Like,
well, and we probably don't want to do this subject for the entire podcast, although I think we could. But I think this does bring up a final angle, which we were talking about earlier today, which is what are the repercussions for the players? Because you know the O-line coach is right now telling them, you know, it's time to pay.
Yeah, you got to run like double suicides or whatever.
Punitive workout. I'm like, but those nuggets don't taste so good now, do they, ladies? Yeah, that shit.
I got to imagine the players were, like, afraid to eat too much, or most of them were, at least. Like, and it's not like they were that excited. Like, that's literally, like, what you eat if you're a college student, to an extent, at least. It's nothing new. It's nothing exciting. It's just McDonald's burgers when you get down to it. So I'd like to think that they just had, like, one or two for the most part and kind of chilled out after that. I don't think they were, like, I think if anyone was, like, really going crazy on the buffet, it would have been the president.
Right. Oh, well, for sure.
But this makes me wonder if Clemson's nutrition team is more on the, you're going to be running triple suicides for that, or end of things, or on the more, like, you know, like Zen monk side of things, like a very peaceful Pacific guy who's like, and how do you feel after you ate that?
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way you do after you have a skinless chicken breast with a side of kale? What is your body telling you?
What do you think the lessons are from that?
And what would be worse? I think I would rather go. I would rather have a guy yelling at me to run until I puke.
It's definitely that. It's Clemson. Yeah. It's a perfectly rectangular man, the color of a Werther's original, just bellowing nonstop. Yeah. There's a lot there.
Nick Saban's boys aren't out there stuffing their faces with Whoppers.
The other thing, and I guess this is the last bit, the thought that I had last night, obviously my personal brand is extremely defective, and I can't unplug it or make it stop. It's just where I am right now. I got sent the same fucking image of him doing the jazz hands behind the burgers maybe a dozen times last night. All of this was happening while I was flying back from Pittsburgh. We were visiting a friend of my wife's and meeting their adorable three-month-old. All very nice. To land, turn on your phone, and then there's just a million... Like, it looks like the fucking Shining because everything is so ornate and elaborate. And then there's just this ghoul back there grinning like Mayor McCheese, you know, like, look on my works, ye mighty, in dismay. Obviously, that was upsetting. My first instinct was that this is actually the first time maybe that Trump has felt like this is what he want. This is what he thought being president would be like.
Oh, absolutely.
This is
yeah.
the dream.
Hanging out with football players and making like a speech to the camera for like an minute and a half
about how many burgers he bought them and how nice exactly. how like they're his friends now mm-hmm. like
and the fact that reporters were like asking him questions about the burgers
yeah that was like the video Giddy sent me like it's not just strangers coworkers and friends send me horrible videos of this whole thing. It was like him doing the scrum outside. The way it's shot, it all looks like very late period David Lynch, like it's like very like fucking second hour of Inland Empire, like horrible spotlights. And he's talking about the burgers and everybody's having such a great time and we don't know. We'll see what happens. And then the reporters start yelling at him and like one person is like, should Steve King resign? Should Steve King resign, Mr. President? And everybody else is just like, what kind of burgers did you get? Are you an onions guy? Do you take the onions off? And that was the whole thing. Anyway, so I guess that's where we are right now as a
society, as a culture.
I was going to say as a podcast, but yes, all of that as well. All right, we must leave it there. So we're going to come back and actually talk about sports because that's supposed to be part of the podcast.
You can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
We're back. And as much as we could think about the harrowing matters we just discussed, there are brighter, happier things to talk about, like the NFL playoffs, where we will have the four highest scoring teams in football competing for the ultimate prize, the four best teams in the NFL. The NFL is no longer a random number generator. It's bringing forth the quality and pitting it against each other for our benefit. What did you guys make of the weekend in playoffs?
I would say three teams look really great, and this isn't really supposed to be a dig at the Rams, but the Rams looked, I think, less great than everyone else. So I'm expecting, I would say, I'm going to pick with my heart and say I'm expecting a Saints-Chiefs Super Bowl. I think the Saints looked really good outside of those first two drives against Philly, and I'm just going to say it, Chiefs are going to beat the Patriots.
I would love to be able to think that. I thought when you were coming back, you went in a much more positive direction, at least until the random number generator part, and then it was just on that Marchman wave. But before that, I thought you were going to be like, you know, it's great, everything's good. The Patriots scored 41 points in the first 20 minutes of their football game, and that was over and whatever. I would love to believe that the Chiefs could beat the Patriots. And I would love to live in a world where Andy Reid just roundly outcoaches Bill Belichick and then, you know, like Kool-Aid mans through into the Super Bowl and does his thing there. I have some doubts.
Yeah, I also have reservations. So I want to hear this. Why do you think the Patriots are not invulnerable?
Well, so if you look at the game the Chiefs and the Patriots played in New England earlier this year, I think it was 45-40 the Chiefs lost off the top of my head. And it was a really great game. The Chiefs pretty much hung in there, even though Mahomes, especially in the first half, didn't look as good as he could have looked.
Yeah, it's like the first time he looked human.
Exactly, but he's more experienced since then. The Chiefs have home field advantage. They do look really good. Like, they're a great team. They probably, on the whole, have more, like, pure talent than the Patriots do. So, I don't know. There's a lot of good reasons to pick the Chiefs. It's just sort of that, like, crippling despair that makes it's everyone only, think
you know,
Patriots
it's not only
good.
The general generic crippling Patriots despair we felt every year for 20 years as a culture and as a society, but when you think about Mahomes and Belichick and the Patriots broadly, there's definitely this like break the cutie angle to it where Belichick coming out with some sort of some sort of new tactical wrinkle that involves putting a spy on him and exposing him as a fraud, like this being the us having already seen everything Mahomes can do because Belichick is going to somehow prove it's all nonsense. It gives me anxiety.
He's going to prepare for Mahomes' like left-hand passes. Mm-hmm. Like he'll just have everything. But
yeah, he's going to be like, Mahomes might not be looking where the ball is, but my players are.
Yeah. And it's funny, like the Patriots, they're not, to me, like they don't seem that good this year. Like the personnel doesn't seem as good as it has in recent years. No, I know, dude. We can talk about the Chargers in general, but like I think it's a good coaching job by Belichick. Not surprising. He's an extremely good coach. But like hearing them do the like nobody believed in us shit now is especially galling.
I honestly think this might be the most annoying version of the Patriots. Coming off a Super Bowl loss, they have that like revenge factor. They have the nobody believed in us factors. I fucking hate watching Julian Edelman. I can't stand watching James White catch 15 passes in a game. Like there's just so much, like so many little things that infuriate me. It's not like
way too much Rex Burkhead in the monitors on Sunday for my taste as well. Like I really don't care for that dude very much.
Yeah, even like Gronkowski was like the one Patriots guy that I could really enjoy. But in the Chargers game, it was all just like focusing on how he blocked. And that was like the big praise he was getting. And yeah, who gives a shit?
Sad. Yeah, that's not fun. And definitely, underdog Tom Brady is the most annoying figure in world sports. I don't think you can come up with
Tom Brady's literally John Cena now. Did you see the Instagram video he did where he's just sort of like yelling into the camera about respect or I don't know exactly, but he was just like doing a Cena promo basically.
He's tired.
They've become the same person.
We need to stop underestimating the strikingly handsome centimillionaire multi-time Super Bowl champion. Like it's time for everybody to show him a little respect.
It's also time to show Drew Brees respect.
He's too short. He'll never make it as an NFL quarterback.
Yeah, I think many people, we've talked about this on the podcast recently, but I think many people are re-examining Drew Brees and they're coming to the conclusion that he is in fact like a quality NFL quarterback who's going to go places in this league.
Lauren, your take.
I think the Saints are the most like complete team right now. Obviously they looked like crap like the very beginning of the game against the Eagles, but the run game looks awesome, passing is obviously amazing, and their defense is pretty good too. So like I don't know. I think all around, they look like the best team.
Also, to impersonate an actual football pundit for 1 second, I'm going to choke saying this, but I liked the adjustments the Saints made because they were getting carved up on the line.
Absolutely getting their ass.
It wasn't just that the Eagles were marching down the field. I mean, Foles was doing fucking crossword puzzles while running his checkdowns. And they figured it out. They changed the game plan and they adjusted. So that was a little bit encouraging.
Yeah, I was watching that game with an Eagles fan in Pittsburgh, and I couldn't stop myself from saying good for them when they ran the fake punt on 4th-and-1. But it was good for them. And I mean, it was like it's not as simple as that being the big momentum swing in the game, and yet also like maybe it's as simple as that being the big momentum swing in the game. Like it was
the punt and a couple interceptions, basically.
They just like stopped seeming afraid. They were absolutely getting beat down at the beginning of it. And I was like, at that point, the Eagles last year like just really, really looked excellent. And to the point where by the time we got to the Super Bowl, I had actually gotten comfortable with the idea that Nick Foles was the guy who could win a Super Bowl. And they sure looked like that again, and then they just abruptly did not. And I think they're very depleted, relative to where they were last year, just talent-wise. And, I do enjoy the Nick Foles postseason experience, but seeing the Saints, like, handle a team that seemed very much to have that, like, energy and destiny on its side I hadn't seen the Saints that much this year. When I had, they looked awesome. Like, the highlights they create are fucking rule, and I love watching them, but I was impressed with, the adjustments on offense and defense, but then also, like, they really are, like, as good as it seems the numbers suggest that they are.
Yeah, and I also, while I get annoyed at overpraise for, creative gadget play, You know, whenever anybody does anything in the NFL that doesn't slot exactly into the way things are done, there are then 5,000 articles about how, you know, they're radical innovators.
Taysom Hill is a household name now, right?
Who are bringing Thinkfluence. That it really is fun, and it is fun. It is actually fun to see them have someone who does not, you know, fit into the round hole and not jam him in.
Yeah, I'm calling
it
out.
Sick as you may be of everybody getting excited about
it. Taysom Hill is going to make some sort of play in the Super Bowl. Like, Breeze is going to pass throw like a screen to him, and then Hill is going to complete a touchdown to Michael Thomas or something, and we will never stop hearing about that for like 5,000 years.
I think it was the sports writer Ivan Carter. I don't know if it was. I think it was him that tweeted that Taysom Hill being praised for this, and then suddenly the idea that like running college quarterbacks are the new, like, you know, cheat code in the NFL. He described it as one of like the most egregious moments in racism history, which it really, I think, is. That it's like the idea that like for so long all these dudes, like people that were way superior athletes to Hill, who is, you know, a terrific player and very useful and stuff like that. But there were plenty of guys like, you know, Hines Ward. They're like, no, your job is like you're going to go over the middle until you can't remember what your middle name is. Like, that's your career. And then like Woodrow Dantzler, who is one of my favorite college quarterbacks ever to watch. It was just like a fucking beast. Like, every play was like a punt return. And then the Cowboys were like, oh, you should return punts. And that was the whole deal. It's like the idea, it's cool that they're using Hill like that. I hope it's not too late for like all these. I mean, that's too late for Woody Dantzler probably, but I mean, for like the idea that the game could be opened up a little bit. I think this is the thing that makes the NFL better, if anything makes it better, is just that it becomes more like college football stylistically, in that it's more open, it's more fun, and it's more diverse, instead of being more and more like the NFL, which is to say just like hyper-legislated and, you know, boring.
So it sounds like we're all pulling for the Saints, and thus we'll have our hopes cruelly dashed.
I like the Rams too, man. During the year, they were – but there's something – they haven't looked great for the last few months, and they did not – look overpoweringly great on Saturday either.
Yeah, their offensive line is amazing, and they just like ran behind that, and it was more than enough for sure. But I don't know, Goff has just kind of petered out. Like, since the really, really spectacular Chiefs game, he's been like fine. He looked awful against the Bears. He didn't look so good against the Eagles. Like, I don't know. He's just like gone a little bit down from what he was midseason.
I didn't watch that game.
So. Cool, terrific. That's great.
I have nothing to add here.
Yeah, that's fine. But yeah, so I mean, in terms of like where we go from here, like this is, last weekend was a fun weekend of football. This, I think these are both promising games. I just, I guess Lauren has already given us her preference for the actual Super Bowl. What is the dread matchup for both of you guys?
I'll defer. Are you fearing?
I think Saints-Patriots would be worse than Rams-Patriots because Tom Brady versus Drew Brees, just the hype that would cause, just the hyperbole of sports writers trying to figure out what to write about those two for 2 weeks and just continually trying to top each other. Like, I don't know. I think that would be worse than at least seeing kind of like a younger upstart team, seeing Todd Gurley try to run over the Patriots. Like, yeah, I'd rather see... If the Patriots advance, I would rather see the Rams play the Patriots.
Yeah, I think Saints-Patriots would be a fun game. And like, I think would be like an interesting sort of like, you know, styles make fights sort of combination of the two. But yes, that would be embarrassing. Like a battle for the soul of like the moderate Republican. Like, where it's like, are you the guy that like fucking loves cops and can't stop talking about cops? Or are you the guy that believes he's like hacked his own genome and like it's has unlocked the secret to permanent success?
Yeah, that's my nightmare, and I think the worst part about that, aside from the how insufferable the Brady Breeze stuff would be, and this is just down to taste, but it would definitely, that game would definitely come down to a key gimmick play or two, which would be insufferably annoying. Like, like Edelman faking a punt and then throwing a touchdown pass to himself.
Yep.
Or something like that. Yeah. Like, I'm 100% sure that is how that game would be decided. Whether you think that's cool or fucking annoying, I guess it's just down to taste.
Yeah. I think it's, we will see. I mean, not that that's, I don't want to leave it on that that awful announcing a note, but I feel like it's, you got to do it. But yeah, none of it is bad, which is good. There's not like a boring team left, which is cool.
I think that's fair.
Even the hateful ones are entertaining in their own way. Which is good. All right, so we solved football. Cool. Should we take a break and figure baseball out, and then we can do the fun bag?
Yeah, that sounds like a plan.
Terrific.
So we'll be back.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life 1 week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back having solved football. Now it's time to solve baseball. Baseball is in the middle of a long-term economic crisis as structural changes in the baseball economy have reduced all incentive for teams to sign good players, which means that we have the likes of Manny Machado and Bryce Harper, among other bright lights, sitting without teams and without realistic offers from what the rumor mill suggests. Some people say it's collusion. Some people say it's not collusion. Where do we come down, Lauren?
It depends on if you need to define collusion as like having specific intent or if it's like if they are specifically communicating with each other to keep salaries down. I think it's just the system is set up in a way where like the current free agency structure really sucks for players. I mean, you look at Machado and Harper, two of the best players in the game, and Machado apparently can only choose between the White Sox and the Phillies, and Harper can only choose between the Phillies and the Nationals. Like, imagine if Kyrie Irving went to free agency and could only choose between, like, the Clippers and the Nets or something like that. Like, it's just a poor system right now where minor leaguers don't get a living wage. Once you get to the majors, you don't get paid fairly, and then everyone, like, gets out of team control, wants a big paycheck, and then it doesn't become worthwhile. So it's just a poor system that needs to be fixed more than I think it is the sort of popular notion of collusion, which is kind of intentionally communicating to keep the salaries down.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I don't agree with it. I agree with it to the extent that, like, I don't believe that there's any, you know, that there's a smoking gun memo that can be unearthed by somebody that will be like all the teams being like every infielder gets 2 years, $20 million. Like, please, like, confirm that you've received this email. Like, probably not. But I think that, like, if we are not doing it in a court of law, I think, and you can say then that collusion is a vibe. Like,
yeah,
it has that fucking vibe. Like, there's just definitely something about this is not the same thing as the Angels overpaying for Albert Pujols when he was 32 years old with questions about how old he actually was and then signing him to a 10-year deal. Like, Harper and Machado hit the free agent market at the age of 26. Like, they're both, I mean, Harper's won a MVP already. Machado is, like, by any measure, one of the best players in baseball and a premium defender at the most important defensive position. Everybody knows all this shit. It's not a question of, you know, the different excuses for why different teams don't want to pay for them is, you know, I suppose it's their business and it's the business of fans that have to, like, deal with it or don't. But, man, it just kind of fucking sucks ass.
I hate Moneyball now. That's sort of where it's led me. I just hate this sort of idea that every fan kind of loves to think like a general manager and wants to kind of be the, like, now that you have access to all those stats, you can kind of like make those moves in your head. But when it's not your money, who gives a shit? Like, when the Brewers signed Yasmani Grandal to, like, I don't know, I think it was 17 million or 18. Something, 18.
The qualifying offer was 17. So that was basically the raise he got.
Yeah. And there were people that I saw saying, like, oh, that seems like a lot to pay for a catcher. And, like, sure, maybe if that's your money, but like it's not, and there's theoretically no limit to the money you can spend in baseball. So yeah. Like, who cares?
It's the second best or best catcher in baseball. The idea that that's, I mean, this is the thing. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the executive cosplay element of it is obviously extremely distasteful. But then there's also this other, like, of who you're siding with. The idea of being like, well, you should be complaining about getting paid $18.75 million to play a kid's game or whatever. Like, how are we still fucking doing that?
I don't even know if the kid's game thing is the argument now. I think it's just like everyone sees themselves as the general managers more than they see themselves in the players. Mm-hmm. So yeah. they want to be a fan of the team that is making the smart choices, not necessarily the team with the coolest guys.
Yeah, and I think that, so I see a bunch of problems here. I agree with both of you. I don't think there's hard collusion going on. One reason is baseball has overlearned this lesson because although it's oddly not talked about as a scandal of the scale it was, collusion one and collusion two were, you know, they ended up making payouts of hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. Like there is no way
the commissioner's office will
they were caught with like memos, you know, saying we're not going to sign free agents. That was hard collusion. And then about 15, I think it was about 15 years ago, there was the softer, what everybody believes was a softer collusion where
the
there was a central
one.
Yeah, there was a central bank with Frank Coonerly, who I believe is still the president of the Pirates, right?
Possibly. I don't know. He's not their lead executive, but yeah, he's, I think, still involved with the organization.
Yeah, so he was in the commissioner's office, and supposedly the way it happened was that teams were not talking to each other, but they were communicating with the commissioner's office. So he would get all the offers that were being made, and then he would signal through wriggling his eyebrows or whatever. You know, if the Cubs were saying we're gonna go after Bill Miller and we're thinking about making a $6 million offer, he would, you know, go waka waka or whatever to talk about how that related to the market. So that was a softer thing. Then there was the bonds collusion, which I firmly believe was an actual, like they got together at the winter meetings one year and Selig was just like, don't fucking sign this guy.
Yeah.
Because he was literally willing to pay for the league minimum as a DH and nobody would take him. So I don't believe that, that was anything. I don't think there's anything like that going on, but I do think there's kind of an intellectual monoculture that's been created by econometric analysis. Part of the problem is that it's so, you know, people talk about Moneyball like it's this hyper sophisticated thing, but like the original thing was literally, you know, depending on which variant of it you want to look at, either Billy Bean being like, you know, hey, walks are good, or the, you know, the more sophisticated thing that the book was actually about was about, you know, swerving left when the market is right.
Just
and
the most
for
basic arbitrage imaginable.
Yeah, like, I mean, this is
find
not
an efficiency and exploit it.
This is not hyper sophisticated stuff. And then, like, a detail in Neil DeMouse. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing his name. I'm not sure if it's DeMouse
it's
or
pronounced
DeMouse.
The Mouse.
At Deadspin, which I recommend everybody read. We'll link it in the blog post for this story. But was about the, you know, the economics of baseball right now and why they're tending in this direction to undervalue star players. And one of the points he made was that a lot of the most sophisticated analysis of the marginal value of a win to a team was done by someone who was an undergrad at Brown like 10 years ago, moved into baseball and became the director of like player operations for the Rays. Without any disrespect to him or the very many smart people in baseball, when you have an undergrad at Brown doing like industry redefining analysis, it suggests that the market is still maturing. So I think generally you've got most of the teams approaching things the exact same way with the exact same tools, coming to the exact same rational conclusions, and no one really being creative about their underlying assumptions. And you know, that's something that some smart team will figure out. Like they will have a light bulb go on and say, you know, if we spend $400 million on payroll, this will in the big picture give us huge competitive advantages as a team and as a business. Like the Dodgers have seemed on the verge of doing that at various points, and then they kind of pull back.
The Brewers did it to a certain extent last offseason, and it worked out very well. I mean, they came a couple of outs and weird bounces away from making the World Series, and it was just basically they took a good team and they decided they wanted it to be very good. And then they realized that you could get Lorenzo Cain for far less than Lorenzo Cain was worth. And they got Christian Yelich from a team that was shedding payroll willy-nilly because it's like just – it was – like some alarm went off in the Marlins kitchen that told them that it was time to do that again. And like, I mean,
but you know what's
it
amazing
shouldn't be that
is,
hard.
You know what? You know where you can tell that there is. It's a hard thing to talk about because if you say like all these guys are looking at spreadsheets, I mean that's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. But people are, you know, they're thinking within the lines a bit about what they're applying their economic analysis to, because you have these situations where like the Rangers decided to be the first team to hire a nutritionist for their minor league system a few years ago. It's like you're talking about people, you know, players who are, you know, bloodlessly as assets worth tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And the idea that, you know,
that they would just eat fast food every night.
Yeah, like give me like hire
because they're not making a living wage.
Exactly.
Too. Hiring, it's like, how do they not know that they're shooting themselves in the foot with this?
Yeah, like hiring
times?
A nutritionist, teaching them how to cook, and giving them enough money that when they're on the road, they can go to the Whole Foods instead of you know, Jack in the Box is like some revolutionary thinking, and then you can scale that up, right? Like, how much is a really great batting or pitching coach worth? I don't know, but if the marginal value of a win on the free agent market is $10 million. You know, some people say it's 8, some people say it's 10, whatever, it's in that area. Do we think that a really good pitching coach is worth 2 wins? That wouldn't seem out there to me. How many coaches are making $10 million? Like, if you wanted a competitive advantage, you could seize it there, but nobody's thinking in those terms. They're all thinking in terms of this very kind of narrow analysis of the marginal value of a win in the market and the time value of money and yada, yada, yada. And then when that happens within the context of the whole fuck system, Lauren was talking about where, like, it is fundamentally broken. When you have players, when they come out of the amateur ranks, are under team control for 12 years, and in only the last 4 of those are they able to make anything approaching market value, and that's with a fucked up arbitration system where it's some old guy who's like, how many RBIs did you have? Because that's the market setting number, which doesn't bear any reality to how teams actually analyze or pay for performance. You know, it obviously needs a very fundamental reorientation so that younger players are paid a lot more and a lot sooner. I think that's the way you'll get more money into the player market.
Yeah, it's just so much easier for teams to go that prospect route, to not have to invest big money into any one person, to just sort of like take a guess on, I don't know, hundreds of different players who don't get paid anything and just kind of see who pans out. It's so much easier to sell that when it's not working.
Right.
It's easier to like, I mean, the payroll is lower.
How would you know if it's working?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's just like the advantage. It's like the process hustle.
Yeah,
know,
exactly. Like you were saying, Marchman, about how like teams just aren't thinking hard enough, but I also think they're just taking kind of a lazy way out sometimes mm-hmm. when the division, they're doing the kind of the fire sale thing.
Yeah, the division that you guys both care about has had, I mean, it's just been defined by that, certainly like this offseason. Like the Twins are kind of shooting their shot within their like cheesy limits. Like the Indians are actively trying to get worse because they basically realize that they could win that division by 2 games.
Yeah, they're like, what do we need for number
the White
one
Sox are going for it at
starters?
Least.
Right, yeah.
Is this our White Sox minute?
I think it's the White Sox minute.
So I'm going to put you on the clock because right now the White Sox actually are interesting. For instance, they signed a guy that I know you're a big fan of last week. You wrote a nice—
John Jay, the wonderful John Jay. I want to take this moment, by the way, to apologize to John Jay for calling him a shitty player when the fact is I've been reminded by many, many, many Deadspin readers, he's much better at playing baseball than I am. And I couldn't hope to come up to the major leagues and not hit home runs or perform as well as he did. And I take that point to heart. He is, in fact, a much better baseball player than I am. And I should have taken that into account.
That will not count against your White Sox minute time. I'm seriously going to start a clock at 60 seconds. We're going to go to a break and come back and do the fun bag. But do you want to just get some White Sox shit out of your system for a minute?
Yeah, I will. Tell me when to go.
3, 2.
I will actually raise a sincerely interesting and exciting point about the White Sox that bears to the conversation we were just having, which is that they are bringing some of their top prospects down to the Dominican Republic with the idea that American-born players can have a better sense of the experience and background of players who are coming up and, you know, try to bridge what can be something of a divide in a lot of clubhouses where you have, you know, Dominican guys over here and you have, you know, guys who have pickup trucks with guns in them over here so that they can.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Work together for the betterment of the team. This is another one of those ideas that's so fucking obvious and costs nothing that it's stunning that this is some sort of revolutionary insight that somebody's had. But it's good they're doing it. And the more creative thinkers that we have, like the Chicago White Sox Brain Trust in baseball, the better.
Yeah, terrific. Also, you got 4 seconds remaining. Let's just carry that forward with some moderate amount of interest into the next episode of the Deadcast. And we'll take a break and we'll come back and open up the fun bag. Good?
Good.
We're back. Before we leave, we have to do what we do with every episode of the Deadcast, which is subject ourselves to the fun bag and the punishment therein. I've selected some questions from the toilet. Lauren, you will get a first shot at every one of these, and you do not need to thank me at all.
Oh, I thought you were going to thank me.
Oh, no. We'll see how
You're
that
welcome.
Works out. Yeah. All right. So we have... I guess this is just going to become like a thing that runs throughout the Deadcast now, because the pancakes thing is not going away. Mm-hmm. For instance, Drew, our comrade who's recovering, asked me to pass along the message that pancakes are yummy. Wanted to get on the record. Everybody's got a fucking take on pancakes. Alex in Chicago says, with all the take of pancakes being bullshit, I have a bullshit food take. Hot dogs, also bullshit. All it is a flimsy, tasteless, cheap meat in the center of too much bread. Plus, the only way to make it better is to add a whole lot of other shit to make it taste moderately good, a la Chicago style. Mm. If a hot dog is an option, then something like a burger or club sandwich are usually also options, all of which are vastly superior. I also don't see this being a food normal people just regularly crave. Am I off? Lauren, is he off?
No, he's not off. Hot dogs are bullshit. I mean, they're a kid's food. It's like saying dinosaur chicken nuggets are bullshit. I'm fine with hot dogs. Like,
drag those nugs.
I'll eat hot dogs at sporting events. I'll put ketchup on them. What I hate, though, is when grown men will come up to me, see the hot dog with ketchup on it, and try to get mad at me or get indignant about that monstrosity, apparently, because having strong opinions about hot dogs makes you 6 years old.
I'm a grown-ass man, and I have really fucking strong opinions about hot dogs.
That you do, you maniac.
I like hot dogs. I like to have them at sporting events. I can't imagine craving them, but I do think Alex is full of shit. For instance, if you are in Detroit and you want like a chili dog, I don't think a club sandwich is necessarily an option at like 11 at night after you've stumbled out of the casino. You can get one in Detroit, but you know, if you're just, you know, out and that's what
Yeah, the Coney Islands in Detroit are their own special thing, I think, for sure. But it's still...
Chicago definitely has, like, you know, hot dogs that are a thing unto themselves. I am not above going to Shake Shack and getting a couple of their...
fake Chicago dogs they do?
Yeah, they're actually surprisingly realistic because they get...
I think it's the best item on the menu.
Yeah, they get the Vienna sausage. But I do think hot dogs... I just said Vienna sausages.
Vienna beef. It's all right.
But I do think they're bullshit in that if you want like a cased meat on a roll experience, I don't know why you're going to be choosing a hot dog over like a kielbasa or a Polish sausage or something. That to me is where their bullshit is, that like anywhere that's going to have a really good hot dog is, with the possible exception of certain like chili dog places, generally going to have kielbasa or Polish sausages there, which are orders of magnitude
better.
Right.
I think that's where Alex really hits the nail on the head. I recognize that hot dogs are a children's food and an industrial product, and like by any measure, you know, an atrocity in a bunch of different ways. And yet, like, you know, 2-3 times a year, I do want a hot dog. There are times, even if I'm at someone's backyard and they're barbecuing something and there's hot dogs available, a hot dog cooked over flame is tasty to me.
On a stick.
Or sure, you know, or whatever, yeah.
All that pink fluid that's been compressed,
you know what,
into
man,
the shape, into a cylindrical shape.
Didn't interrupt you when you were giving your answer.
Bubbling and...
Yep. Yeah, no, all right. Yeah, sure. Look, I'm aware of it, but I didn't say it's something that it's happening. It's not happening to me right now. It's not like, but, you know, every now and then, it's contextual. So at a ball game, sure, but the presence of superior options and also the necessity of tricking out this like sort of neutral salt tube of just anuses and eyeballs is not, we can all do better than that. Like, not just in terms of like as a society, but I mean, like, if you're at a Mets game, you can get a sausage and pepper sandwich, which is a similar sort of experience, but actually has taste in it.
Yeah, but you know what I do got to say? I think I might have to get one for lunch now, because I was thinking about those, you know, those like mysteriously red onions that Dirty Water Dog guys put on? Like, nobody, you know, people like rhapsodize about Chicago dogs or pinks and or whatever. Nobody really gets rhapsodic about those onions from hell. I don't know like how they're made or where they come from.
What happened to them? Clearly, like, it's like some subterranean soubrette organized facility, but they. But
if you're in the mood, God, those are really good.
Also, this is the second time that Tim has been completely revealed himself as a suggestible child. He ate Wendy's today because of the picture of fucking Trumpy doing the like, check me out behind a bunch of Wendy's. That happened to him. Anyway, here's our next question from Tony. How many different people do you think the average person has infected with illness in their lifetime?
Oh.
For colds, people are generally contagious at least 24 hours before showing symptoms. So even someone that takes great care when sick has probably gotten at least a couple dozen people sick by touching a doorknob that they coughed on. Then you have the people that you are close to, but that have no choice but to be smothered in your germs. I'm thinking at least 100 people, but I could be way off in either direction.
I think that might be fair. There's a lot of math there. But I think... I got to imagine it stays like pretty low the first 18 years of your life, where if you're sick, you just stay home.
But then you go high though, because you're making your parents sick over and over and over again.
Maybe, but I'm thinking when you go off to college, you just like move into just like an infestation of germs. It's so gross. Yeah. You're going to be sick like just all the time,
just
pretty much.
A vertical petri dish full of serial masturbators with terrible diets. That's what it's all about. you can't survive that. That is a very...
So I think the number skyrockets at age 18. I have no idea exactly how much, but yeah.
Is your instinct more or less than 100?
I think 100 seems about right. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little lower. For me at age 23.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. I didn't realize you were so young. You never
mentioned that.
That never comes up, Tim.
I actually hope we have some epidemiologists in the audience who can answer that, because I wouldn't be surprised if it was like 100 or, you know, 50,000. Although I do think it depends on where you live, because if you grow up in New York and you spend the rest of your life there, you are spraying germs all over thousands of people
and
every
having
day
them sprayed on you in turn. I mean,
yeah.
It's really just,
I mean, you
want to
talk about you can talk about college being a petri dish, but any serious subway anywhere in the world is the most disgusting possible environment, and I think New York's is probably the most disgusting.
Yeah, even if it's clean, even if it's like some antiseptic a subway in a country with a functioning social democracy, for instance, as a system of government, one of those where the trains come when they're supposed to and they're not just like there's no visible pools of standing fluid in them. It's still a lot of people. People are gross and covered in germs. So like there is definitely that. I feel like when I was freelancing hardcore and seldom leaving the apartment, mentally I was extremely unhealthy, but physically I almost never got sick, because the only person that really could have made me sick would have been my wife, a bartender, or one of the like five friends that I would go get beers with, which is fine, you know, like, and it wasn't fine. Obviously, I had and still have a lot of problems as a result of that period in my life. But I do think that once you start working in an office or living in a dormitory or anywhere where you're just like surrounded by a large group of people, it would be certainly there, you know, I can point my finger at a number, probably a dozen instances off the top of my head of times that like my nephew and niece have like directly A to B made me sick because they're like little kids and they go to a school with other little kids and they're just constantly covered in boogers, covering
spitting
each other in boogers.
On each other, yeah. Licking each other, like blowing their noses on each other's shoes. Yeah. Like
that was like a game.
Not washing their hands.
That my niece had for a while was to try to cough on me. That's not a fun. First of all, what are even the rules of it? How do you know if you've won?
You get coughed on,
right?
You lose.
Yeah. Right. That's what I was going to say. Like I kept losing because I refused to play. When she went low, I went high, and as a result, yeah, like I got like fucking bronchitis from somebody that weighs 25 pounds. These things do happen, but it's like the idea of just like being in a world full of people that then as it expands to your friends having kids or you having kids or whatever, there's so many more vectors for it.
Like, also, your mentality changes so much. Like my daughter had an illness last week that once it stopped being contagious, she didn't even have to miss school. It has like a very short incubation period. But then she had a rash that made her look like something out of a zombie movie. And she was going over to a friend's house and my wife just explained like, I know she looks like living death, but it's not contagious anymore. And her friend's mom was like, oh, you know, sure. Well, yeah, you know. It's just when, you know, before I was a parent, I would not have been able to imagine that. I would have thought that, you know, people were much more interested in quarantining their kids, but they just get sick so much because they're constantly doing disgusting things with each other that you just throw up your hands and you're like, are they bleeding out of their eyeballs?
Right. Does it seem to be something that there's a vaccine for? Like, is it that serious? Because otherwise, yeah, my nephew showed up at Thanksgiving and the first thing he said when he came in the door was like, I threw up pomelo in the car. And I was like, tight. And then a day later, like, it wasn't pomelo, but like, I was right there with him. And it was all because like, he was just whatever. I played with him and stuff. But you can't, like, my sister couldn't have been like, we're not coming to Thanksgiving. My son just threw up pomelo in the car.
Yeah,
like,
he probably dropped a hot dog in the sewer and then ate it.
Right.
Like, 5 minute rule. I'm going to fish it out.
They all float down there. We have time for, we can do a secular question and a Trump question, or we can just go directly to the Trump question, which I think is very compelling. What's your instinct?
I kind of want to know what the secular question is now that you brought it up.
Yeah, I want to know what it is. I'm always in favor of more fun bag. I love subjecting myself to punishment.
Let's do it then. All right. Is it deranged, evil, or simply unnecessary to name your kids something normal and then spell it in a really unusual way?
Ooh.
I'm not talking about spellings of names that sound the same but vary from one culture to another. I'm talking about, like, let's say you name your kid Elizabeth or Amy, but you spell it Elizabeth or Amy. or you can spell those. Kelly had E-L-Y-Z-A-B-Y-T-H or A-Y-M-E-E. Or name your kid Jonathan, but spell it Jonathan, which Lauren instead of Lauren, or Emma or Emma. I know it's your right to name your kid anything you want other than Adolf or Fuckwad, but that doesn't make it nice or cool. How deranged, evil, or simply unnecessary is this?
What's the Lauren variation? You just kind of said it.
L-O-R-E-N-N-E.
Oof. I think with a long enough name, you are allowed one slight variation. Like the Elizabeth example, I think it's a long enough name, you can drop one Y
yes,
in there.
That's what I was going to say.
I think two is overkill, but I think you get one variation for every like four syllables.
Choose wisely, but you have to choose.
Yeah.
You can't just be like everything.
Just one letter too. Like no like Jonathan bullshit, W's in there.
Tim, thoughts?
I don't know about deranged or evil, but it's definitely unnecessary. But I have very, very, very bland taste in names. Like if we had if we pulled a Philip Rivers and just filled the house with kids, they would all be named like
Quiverful Timmy,
like Elizabeth and Charles and things like that. I don't think we would depart from anything that would have been a popular name like 150 years ago.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to redact myself here because the unique name variant, especially of a common name, is far enough from my mental space that I can't, like, I just don't feel any commonality there?
I've always been very judgmental of unconventionally I can stop there. Of unconventionally spelled normal names. Like, I've just been like, why do you, you know, like, if you want to get weird, then get weird. And I feel like there are families, my family to a certain extent is one of these, just in terms of my sister's name versus mine. But you'll see it sometimes, and I might be wrong about this, but Barkevious Mingo, who's one of my favorite names in all of sports and the entire universe, has like a brother whose name is also very dramatic. But then I believe he has a third brother whose name is like Dan. And to me, like, I don't think you need to commit throughout the entire family, but I do think it's the sort of thing where, like, if you're going to commit to the bit, if you want to give your child an unconventional name, like, name your child Barkevious Mingo. Don't name him like Barry, but it's spelled like B-H. Like
B-U-R-Y.
Yeah, right. And it's just like a schwa in there. Like, don't. You don't get to do that. But yeah, to a certain extent, I'm live and let live with this. Like, I want to be more live and let live than I am. Like, I support anybody in their wishes to name their child whatever they want, but I also reserve the right to privately style on them in an annoying way.
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
Our last question, our Trump question of the week, actually came through the comments of our post last week, a conversation I had with user Normcore Rockwell. I found this one very compelling. Anytime I enjoy something, say a nice holiday party with coworkers, I immediately start thinking, how would Trump ruin this? So if Trump participated in a white elephant gift exchange, what priced item would he bring? Because I'm pretty sure he has no idea what's worth $10 to $20 in today's dollars. So he'd either get something like a Trump-branded number two pencil, or he would bring a mink coat. But would he be able to take his turn? How would he react to having his gift stolen? Or no one wanting the Trump coffee mug he picked up at the White House gift shop? I'd pay good money to watch this Yankee swap. Lauren, game this out.
As far as, like, what gift he would bring, maybe you guys can help me out with this, because my default thing with Trump is that, like, his brain turned off in the late 90s, or probably late 80s, yeah, early 90s. So I'm thinking he gets some sort of gift that was, like, really sort of trendy, some sort of fad from that era.
That's really good.
But
Cabbage Patch Kid.
That could work, yeah. He thinks, like, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are still, like, the most popular thing in the country. Yeah. Something like that. So, like, Chia Pet is maybe a good... I don't know... I feel like he would spend more money than that, but like a Chia Pet, like that kind of thing is like a good start. Something like ridiculously outdated, like you don't know where in a mall he could have possibly gone to get
useless
this.
Garbage for people he doesn't respect.
I think you're on an MC Hammer cassette tape.
Yeah. So just to add to Lauren's thing, he would possibly have a custom Chia of himself, a cast of his face in clay that then when you plant the seeds, it grows into a magical Trumpy hair.
I'm 100% sure what he would bring, which would be an autographed picture of himself that he didn't autograph. That they have like that machine to automatically do autographs. Yep. He would have that and it would not be framed.
It would say like to Gary, best wishes, and there's like no one named Gary in the office. Just like, all right, enjoy it. Have fun. We're gonna see what happens. The other thing that occurs to me, just again, we were talking about his tastes would be like an extremely large version of some Hershey's.
Oh my god, those product. Those novelty candy bars, yeah.
Yeah, but like a large, like a shitty one, like Mr. Good Bar or like a white chocolate one. Like I think he's like kind of a white chocolate guy, it seems like that to me, because it like he's like, oh, it's cleaner, you know? And like that would be like a big thing that he would bring. In terms of him being willing to play by the rules of a Yankee swap thing where your gift can be taken from you and then you have to select another one, absolutely not.
He wouldn't be able to follow any of that.
In a huff. No. It's just not in him to be able to do that.
No, clearly not.
I mean, it's not honestly, in him, I don't think, to watch other people open presents.
Yeah.
Like I don't think he could handle just like those 10 seconds or
He'd
whatever.
He'd be so bored. That's like, I think the thing with him that, again, of all the bring it full circle and the things that are actually like relatable about him, but also in the sense just they're relatable if you've ever been 8 years old, are all these stories of him having like world leaders over and he's like, everybody gets ice cream. I get two scoops. And everybody gets one. That's our fucking guy right there. So yes, he would absolutely break out in hives at a Yankee swap and I would also like to watch it. I may as well end it there, right? Lauren, thank you for joining us.
Seems like a depressing enough note.
I knew it would present itself sooner or later. Tim, as always, it's a pleasure. The show is produced by our executive director of audio, Mondano Mafidi. Featured music by Corbin Hayes, and the episode was mixed by Jamie Colazzo. Got a question you want to send us? Send a voice note or email to deadcast@deadspin.com or tweet at Deadspin using the hashtag Deadcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Panoply, NPR One, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, buddies. Yeah.